This is Sign Language. Sign Language. With Bruce Williams and Doc Goldstein.
Hi, and welcome to episode 173 of Sign Language. You probably didn't think we were coming back. This is Bruce Williams from signlanguagepodcast.com.
And this is Doc Goldstein from California.
How are you, mate?
You know, I'm not bad, actually. Everything, you know, being equal, I'm busy.
All things considered.
Yeah. Yeah. Busy's good, though, you know.
Definitely. What have you been up to?
Well, I'm doing a lot of teaching, and I'm just really enjoying it, you know. A chance to poison the minds of innocent young people everywhere.
Now, you were saying just before we started recording that you've picked up a gig at a second college?
Yeah, I'm at a second college, and I don't know if I should say the name of it or not, but it's really great, and the people are great, and there's this massive SSL duality console in here, you know, in there.
Whoa.
You know, and that thing has been a head trip because it's different signal flow-wise than most other large format consoles, so it's been interesting.
Yeah, right. So I'm guessing this is not a community college. This is more like a media college.
It is. It is.
And of sorts.
It's,
yep.
Yeah, and it's nationwide. They've got outlets all over the place.
Wow.
It's very impressive. Nice. It's very impressive. And I've met so many great people there. You know, it's just, you know, and they put up with me, so.
That's awesome. Well, the reason I was keen to talk about this is because, you know, as listeners to the podcast know, in October of last year, I got retrenched from my position at the Australian Radio Network. And in the 6 months since then, I've sort of been kicking around ideas as to what do I do next, you know, and I've applied for numerous jobs and been shortlisted for a couple but not got them. And one that I thought I was an absolute shoo-in for, I got a rejection letter for the other week, just didn't even get an interview, which has just kind of blown my mind. But along the way, Kath said to me, you should really talk to the local community colleges about, you know, doing a course with them. And so I approached there's sort of really only one in my area, and said to them, look, how about a course on a little bit audio engineering and a little bit about creating and publishing a podcast.
Wow.
And
wow.
Yeah, and the girl that I spoke to initially, she was only sort of lukewarm on the idea. She said, "Oh, okay, I don't quite get it because it's not my area of expertise, but she said I'll bounce it off the boss and see what he thinks." Anyway, she emails me a week later and she said, "The boss absolutely loves the idea and wants to meet with you." So I went back there for a second chat and met with the guy who runs the college. And I don't know if in the US whether your community colleges do it in much the same way as they do it here, or if it's different, but they have what are known as accredited courses, and then they have what are known as lifestyle courses. So a lifestyle course means you don't end up with a certificate of achievement or anything like that at the end. It's not something that you could take to a potential employer and go, well, I've done this course and that will actually mean something. It's just a course that they run that people would do because they're just interested in it, but it would have no industry bearing. And so initially, the conversation I had with this community college was that, yes, they'd love to have me do this course, but it would only be a lifestyle course. But I just got a phone call back from the girl I was initially dealing with, Paula, this morning, saying the boss is really excited about this course that you want to run, and he wants to know whether or not we can get it to that level where we can run it as an accredited course, meaning that people would actually end up with a certification at the end of it. So it's all kind of a little bit exciting and a little bit scary all at the same time.
Oh, it's great. You know, there's no one more suited than you to do that. It's just fantastic, you know. I hope they realize.
Thank you, mate. I appreciate the vote of confidence, but I have to say I'm a little bit, you know.
So one of the things about community colleges that I didn't know about, but it makes sense, is that they have these learning management programs that everything is based off of. And there's a bunch of them.
Right.
there's canvas and there's Brightspace and there's Blackboard. And learning how to use these programs was not only unexpected, but they're not easy to learn, you know?
Oh, okay.
So I've got my grades in there and I've got my lessons in there, you know, and I've got links to microphones and consoles. I have a link to Sylvia Massey, who's a fantastic engineer.
Yeah.
Things like that. And I don't know her, but she's so good, right? So I linked to a YouTube video of her. You know, things like that, but it took me a while. And then there's also, you have to grade and you have to have a lesson plan and, you know, so.
Yeah.
So the subject matter is easy. It's the everything else that's not.
Yeah. So here in Australia, we used to have a thing called Train the Trainer, which was essentially a course that you would have to do to prove that you were capable of conducting a course and teaching people and, you know, marking and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That has been upgraded over the last 20 odd years, and it's now called a certificate for in training and assessment. And I'm currently in the process of doing my cert for in training and assessment. It's a 12-month course to do. And when Paula rang me this morning and said, hey, you know, the boss is really excited about this course and wants to know if we can step it up to being an accredited course, which means it would be nationally recognized.
Oh.
I said to her, you do realize I don't have my cert for yet, right? And she said, that's fine. Don't worry about it. She said, I can mentor you through that. Because she's been in the training and assessment game for like 30 years, like as long as I've been in audio. And she said, yeah, don't worry about that. She said, I had a person come to us recently who, you know, wanted to run a course and, you know, and an accredited course, and they haven't updated their skill set since they did Train the Trainer 20 years ago.
Well, you are the person who can learn a course like that because they get to be a little convoluted. Isn't that a great word, convoluted, by the
convoluted.
Way?
Convoluted. It's a great word, yeah. Yeah.
I'm not talking about reverb either, you know, but it's convoluted.
No,
but,
yeah, exactly.
But once you figure it out, it makes it easier because it helps you have direction to your lesson plans, and it calculates the grades automatically. Students take the tests inside the software, turn in their assignments that way, and it's really great, but there's a learning curve. Not unlike this SSL console I've been playing with.
Yeah, I'll bet. It must be a lot of fun to play with something like that, though.
You know, I'm very impressed by it. It is just a remarkable piece of kit, as you would say. It's so well made. And the EQ and the compression in it is so good, but the signal flow is different. You know, this console is designed to be used with the workstation.
Right.
So the 24-track bus assigns are not necessary to get to Pro Tools. They're mainly there for, you know, going to a separate set of buses if you need to, but you don't need to just to start recording and mixing. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, right. So I have to ask, without disclosing your former employer, the console that you showed me at your workplace all those years ago.
Those were Harrison MPC-Ds, MPC-4Ds.
Yeah, so I was going to say, that Harrison console, that was a digitally controlled analog console. Is the SSL you're looking at a similar sort of thing, where it's an analog signal path but digitally controlled?
Well, let's get a little back history on the Harrisons. So, yes, they were digitally controlled analog at one time, but we ended up changing out the racks in the back room.
Right.
And rebuilding the consoles, and they were all digital for a few years before I retired from there. So,
wow.
And we even did a test where we had both sets of electronics on at the same time, and we tested some EQ and some compression and compared the analog and digital, and it was pretty good, you know.
Interesting. And could you tell any difference?
Hardly.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, and the guys at Harrison, they're in Nashville, Tennessee, you know.
Yep.
And they are fantastic. They really are great. It actually didn't hurt us at all that we didn't have an LA outlet because their customer service was so good. I mean, if we needed somebody out here, they'd fly somebody out the next morning. But the consoles are bulletproof. They're just bulletproof, but, you know. And this SSL is the same way. Now, there's an SSL office here in town.
Right.
And I don't know if we'll ever need to call him, except, you know, I've called him a couple of times to ask him some stupid routing questions, like, duh, what does this switch do, you know? But I just have to say, it's just a truly professional piece of equipment in every way. It's solid. Yep. It sounds amazing. There's no noise or distortion anywhere unless you want it. You know, I'm very impressed.
Nice.
We had an SSL at my old place for a while, but it was a different version. It was a 5000 series, which was made for film mixing, but this is a record board.
Right.
You know, it's a 48-channel record board, and so it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
Nice. Nice. Well, while we're on the subject of EQ, I was looking back at my notes, and we had an email from Theo Goodman months and months and months ago. And I'm trying to remember whether or not we addressed the last part of Theo's email, which was about EQ. If you remember that we've covered this, please tell me. He said, Doc mentioned two things that I did not quite understand.
Huh. Only two?
Why do you get phase shift smearing with analog EQ but not with digital? He also warned that the effect of analog EQ is more pronounced than that of digital for the same numerical amount of dB adjustment. Why is that? So did we address any of those questions?
I don't think we did, but I can say that in analog, equalization is created by capacitors and sometimes inductors, and those have phase shift away from zero in just how they work. And I don't want to get into a bunch of electronic theory, but capacitors...
Can we get into it a little bit?
A little bit. Capacitors are 90 degrees out from standard resistors in terms of phase relationships.
And I'm just going to jump in there for a sec. If my understanding is correct, a capacitor is like a battery with a short-term life. Like it fills up with electricity and then it empties out. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. Capacitors are amazing because they act like they're passing signal, but they actually aren't, because the definition of a capacitor is two conductive plates separated by a dielectric, which is a non-conductive material. So juice doesn't actually get through the thing.
Right.
But it acts like it does, because if in one phase, or in one polarity, the electrons all pile up on the one plate, and their presence is felt on the other side, even though there's a dielectric there. So the other side becomes positive, and all the electrons want to head toward that because they're negative and they love positive.
Yep.
And then when it's alternating current, and then when the current switches around, the plate that was negative becomes positive, and now then the other plate is negative, and now the electrons run the other direction. So looked at from outside the capacitor, it looks like it's passing signal back and forth, but it's actually not. And because of the way it works, capacitors pass high frequencies. They block DC completely, and the frequency at which they start to pass high frequencies can be adjusted by the value of the capacitor and the resistors hooked up to it and all the other crap that's in the circuitry, you know?
Right.
So you could have a capacitor run to ground and flush high frequencies out, or you can have it go to a positive feedback or a negative feedback loop. You can put it in series.
Okay.
And then only high frequencies get through that series connection. So they are often used to couple stages of circuitry and block the DC from getting through. So like if you have, just as an example, if you have a tube amp and you've got 400 volts sitting on the plate, you can have a capacitor block that. So at the other side, you just get the AC, which is the musical part. So,
right.
But capacitors, you know, they take some time for that buildup to happen. And so they slip phase a little bit away from what's going on without the capacitor.
So when you say they take a bit of time, we're talking microseconds, right?
Oh, probably less than that. Yeah.
Right. So
there's this thing called a time constant that you calculate for.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm not a good math person.
Okay.
But, you know, I know the calculations, you know.
Yeah. So when you said a capacitor is 90 degrees out, what did you mean?
Well, I forget if it's delayed or advanced, but I think it's delayed. So a capacitor, if you have signal going through a resistor And then you also have the same signal splitting off and going through a capacitor, an RC network, where there's a capacitor and a resistor. At the output of both of those nodes, the signal will not be exactly in phase.
Right. I see what you're saying. Yep.
Because there is phase delay because of the way reactive parts work. So there's resistance, which is resistors, and there's reactance, which and reactance. Man, did you put me on the spot or what?
Sorry, man.
So it's all right. So reactance is it's frequency dependent resistance, if you will. So a capacitor, the higher the frequency goes, the less reactance you have.
Right.
And at DC, you have total blockage. And then in inductors, which are not always used in circuits, but when they are, they act the opposite. You know, they tend to block higher frequencies and pass low frequencies.
Oh, okay. Right.
You know, so you can build an EQ circuit. In fact, Rupert Neve has these EQs. He calls the Shelford EQs.
Right.
And he's gone ahead and used inductors in that. And, you know, he's a master of audio transformers and coils.
Totally. Right?
You know, so an inductor is a coil.
Right.
And actually, I haven't heard one of these units, but I'll bet it's amazing. So I'm actually making it a point to go to one of my pro audio dealers here in town and check them out, because I'm sure they're amazing. But that's a short version. I hope that helps, Theo.
So what we should have done was, before I let you get off onto that rant, was to explain what is meant by smearing.
Well, smearing, you know, if you have a lot of different signals going down combined and they're going through a node like that, an electronic node, you know, and there's reactants in there, the reactants that is going to smear it, because you've got some of the signal is at 0 degrees and some of the signal is now not because of the reactants.
So certain parts of the frequency band are being time delayed by, you know, a percentage of a cycle.
Time delayed or advanced, because capacitor is not fully charged, electrons really move that way. And meanwhile, the resistor is slowing things down at a constant rate. So, and then when the capacitor fills up, you know, it stops conducting at lower frequencies. And
right.
There comes a point when the signal has to make up its mind. Am I going to go through this 10K resistor, or am I going to go through this capacitor? And I see it at higher frequencies, it's a lower impedance, so I'll go that direction. But as soon as the frequency of myself gets lower near the time constant of the capacitor, then I'm going to find that the resistor is easier to go through than the capacitor, and now I'm going to go that way. And of course—
Right, so the whole path of least resistance argument, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, and you can control that with a pot, you know, that's what knobs are for, right? So,
wow.
So I'm sure I'm butchering this, and any electronic teacher out there that's hearing that wants to slap me on the side of the head, but I think I got it right.
No, look, I would say, if there's anyone listening who understands electronics and feels that there's any room for correction in what Doc has said, please let me know, because I'm really keen to learn that stuff. It's not an area I've ever delved into, not in any serious capacity anyway. I'm fascinated by it all. So,
well, really good analog equipment designers are pretty good at math. You know, there's a lot of math when you calculate out all the time constants of the circuitry and the series parallel networks and all that happy stuff. And pi is involved when calculating frequency ranges and cutoff points. So, you know, 3, 1, 4 and all that.
So my other question is, how audible is smearing, really?
Well, that's a good question, you know, but I can just tell you that analog EQ sounds different than digital EQ, and it really is more sensitive. You know, if you barely move a knob, a boost and cut knob in analog, and you can hear it right now, but in digital, you got to go a little farther before it makes as big a difference. And when it does make a difference, let's just be realistic. So you've done your share of mixing, and it's good work.
Thank you.
But when you're using EQ,
yep.
You can hear that, say you boost something around 7K because you want to give a little edge to the vocal, right?
Yep.
You hear that immediately in analog.
Yep.
But in digital, it's so clean.
Yep.
That you don't hear it immediately. You got to go a little farther.
Do you know what?
I mean, that's just the way it is.
It's funny you mention that, because middle of last year, I think the Waves had a decent special going, and I took the plunge and I bought the gold bundle.
They have one now, actually. They have another sale right now.
Yeah, well, I've noticed ever since I actually bought into Waves that they're having a sale like every week. There's just something different that's on sale each week. But what I discovered amongst the gold bundle is a couple of plugins called VEQ3 and VEQ4. And what I've noticed is that those couple of plugins are modeled on analog gear. And I have noticed that, yeah, it doesn't take as much of a boost or a cut with those couple of plugins to really hear something happening. Whereas if you go to something like their Q series EQ, like the Q4, Q6, Q8, Q10, those you need to, you know, dial in higher or lower numbers to get an equivalent amount of boost or cut. And those ones that are modeled on analog hardware, I really do notice that they seem to be more sensitive. You don't need as much boost or cut. So I don't know whether, you know, digitally they've done something to make them more responsive, but it's interesting that you mentioned that.
I think most of their products that are modeled after analog equipment have a digital analog switch. And if you switch it toward the analog side,
that's correct.
There's a little bit of distortion in there, a little non-linearity that throw in, and that might be what you're hearing. Because for those of you out there who tried adding high end to your snare drum and you still didn't get the snap that you wanted, try adding a little distortion to it, because that's all high harmonics, folks.
Totally. Totally.
You know?
Do you know what? This is an anecdote that is related to what Doc's just said about adding distortion to a snare drum. I have noticed whenever I'm trying to mix sound effects in a radio commercial, anything that is short and sharp and transient, it can sometimes be really hard to get that sound effect to cut through in a mix. And a prime example of this is a golf swing. And what I have found is that running a golf swing, you know the sound I'm talking about, right? When a nice big chunky, you know, iron driver hits that golf ball off the tee, it's that real sharp thwack, you know, and you get a little bit of an early reflection kind of sound from that impact. And it can be really hard to get that to cut through a mix in a radio commercial because it's such a short, sharp transient. And I have found that adding some distortion to that, particularly to golf swings, does wonders for getting that to cut through in a mix. And I'd say that's almost parallel with the snare drum example.
Yeah, you know, there's something I do with compression that helps things last longer. And there's also plugins now that can help the decay and attack time of a transient signal last longer.
Right.
But one of the things, and we probably talked about this, but, you know, I have no memory sims plugged in, so I don't remember. But, you know, if you compress a snare drum, you can set the attack time so it doesn't do anything until after the initial transient.
Yeah.
And then what you can do is, and then it'll crush the rest of the signal, and you can take the gain makeup and bring that up so it's as loud as a transient. And in that case, you've made your snare drum a lot fatter and last longer. So now instead of maybe 4 seconds of transient, you can get it up to, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 milliseconds.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And that really helps. So if people have been wondering, you know, somebody asked me not long ago, if compressors turn things down, how does that work where when you put a compressor on it, it makes it sound bigger? That doesn't make sense because they're turning down the high stuff. I said, yeah, they are. But when they hit the gain makeup, they're turning everything back up again, not only the lowered loud stuff, but they're bringing up all the soft part, and that's where the trick is.
Yeah, that's right.
And I don't know that anybody teaches that, except you probably will be now. great, man. I'm so happy.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm excited, but like I said, nervous at the same time. But I'm sure I'll be fine once I get into my element. But the thing I wanted to say about, you know, what you're saying about using a slow attack on a snare, that's great as long as your drummer is consistent in how hard he hits the skin.
Well, if he's not, that's what samples are for.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
You know, I can't tell you how many drummers I've put samples on top of, and not one of them has called me and asked me about, hey, how come my kick drum sounds better?
Yeah, right.
It sounds great, but that doesn't sound like my drum. I have not heard that. I have not had that phone call.
So when you do that, do you deliberately look for a sample that is tonally very similar to what you captured off the mic?
Nah. I just put in something I know will work.
Right.
Fair enough.
I figure all the drummers are from Spinal Tap, so I don't need to worry about it.
Nice. Nice. Awesome. There was one other thing that I had still sitting in my little text document of notes for the next episode of this podcast. And it was an article that I saw on ProSound Web probably a couple of months ago now. And I thought it was interesting. It was by a guy called Daniel Keller, but it was an article about gain staging and why gain staging is still important in the digital era.
Oh, this is one of my pet peeves. So you've just lit me up.
Well, now it'll be interesting to see whether you and I are on the same page, because I've seen a few different sources around the web over maybe the last 12 to 18 months saying in the digital realm, gain staging is not as critical. And I don't subscribe to that point of view. And I'd be keen to hear.
Me either.
You either?
I don't either. No. See, here's the deal. More blathering from me, sorry.
No, that's why you're here, mate.
a lot of workstations use 32-bit floating point as a sample rate.
Yep.
And 32-bit floating point, because of the moving decimal point, won't really distort, you know, because the decimal point saves your butt. But the problem is that in the professional world, 24-bit, which is not floating point, is part of the specification for delivery requirements and everything else.
Yep.
So I see people who are not experienced working at 32-bit floating point and just completely ignoring gain staging. And then when they have to output it at 24-bit to go for the delivery requirement, all of a sudden there's all this fuzz tone and they're clipping all their plugins because they didn't know. You know?
Yep.
And I just watched that parade go on by, you know? It's just amazing. So,
yeah.
So if you out there in podcast land have a digital workstation and your sample rate is a 32-bit floating point, and a lot of them are like the non-HD versions of Pro Tools, and I don't know about Reaper. But,
Reaper will work at 32-bit, yep.
Yeah, so you can get away with stuff at 32-bit floating point that is not kosher, and it'll bite you if you don't gain stage properly, because all of a sudden, you know, look, let's say that you have a Waves Renaissance EQ.
Yep.
And you crank it up pretty good and you add, you know, 10 dB at some frequency, you know, hopefully not 14K because that'll slice everybody's head off. But let's just say that you do.
Yeah.
Most people also don't realize that when they do that, they're lowering their headroom before clipping at that frequency.
Yep.
Well, that might not matter so much for 32-bit floating point. But Martha, I gotta tell you, when it goes to, you know, 24-bit, you're hosed, man.
Yeah. Somewhere you're gonna have to bring that 10 dB down.
Oh, yeah.
Ready for delivery. But you see.
So bring it down right away because, you know, even if you clip that plug in and it still sounds okay, you might think to yourself, oh, I got away with it. Mm. But you do that as a matter of course because you don't know any better and you do that, you know, say 10 times in a mix or 20 times or 40 times in a mix, and all that stuff adds up. And the next thing you know, your mix doesn't have that depth and that cleanliness that it had before. And now you're wondering why. Well, that's probably why.
Yeah. So, there's a couple of things that bug me about this mythology that's getting around on the internet about, you know, gain staging doesn't matter in a DAW. One is when you start telling uneducated people that, they're not going to worry about the input level that's hitting the ADC.
Right.
And gain staging is absolutely critical at that point. You know?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Duh.
What happens after the ADC? Sure, you can bend some rules once it's all digital data and it's captured at 32-bit. And as you said, when it's floating point data, there's a lot you can do with that. And that's the stuff that I've seen. You know, I've seen the guy I'm thinking of and you know, people who are listening to this can probably work it out if you know the stuff that I consume in terms of media, can probably work out who it is I'm referring to. And I've seen this video, you know, where he'll crank a plug in by 100 dB with the, you know, the source muted so that he's not hearing it, and then he'll put in another plug in that cuts the signal by 100 dB, and then he, you know, unmutes the first track, and hey, the output's exactly where it started. And it's like, yeah, okay, that's fine in theory, But
so you know those jackets that have all the buckles on the back, you know, and the sleeves buckle together. You know, I have one for this guy.
Straight jacket, yeah.
You know, or I have one for whoever's hiring him.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And I can say this with impunity because I don't know who you're talking about.
Yeah, but he's
probably
I'm not going to call him out because he's a respected guy, and he, you know, and he does, for the most part, talks a lot of sense. But that one, I just kind of go, yes, you're right in theory, but I wouldn't be espousing that as, you know, something that potentially unknowing viewers of your YouTube channel are going to pick up on that and may not understand why that's not always a good practice, you know?
Well, if you distort something and then you turn it down in the next stage, all you get is softer distortion.
Well, yes, exactly. Exactly.
So he's obviously using floating point, you know?
Yep.
But if he ever has to deliver something that's not floating point, he's going to have a headache.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So it's an interesting can of worms, but it bothers me because people who don't know anything will go to YouTube and see that and misconstrue the message. And that's what bothers me.
Well, there's a lot of forums too that have trolls on
them. Oh, yeah.
You know, there's,
of course.
You know, I don't know that they're bots from Russia, but there's a lot of trolls out there.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the notes that I wrote down was, plugins specifically modeled on analog gear still need to see an input that's in the sweet spot. You know, so, yeah, I'm sure you could overdrive the input to a plugin that's modeled on analog hardware. It would be interesting to see how that type of plugin would respond to this approach of, you know, 100 dB input, you know, above unity.
Well, it's going to have more distortion because a plugin that's modeled on a specific analog piece of equipment is designed to act like that piece of equipment would
exactly.
when it's got something bigger that it can swallow jammed down its technical throat, you know?
Exactly.
So I have a plugin called Decapitator.
Right.
And if I need something to be fuzzed out or overdriven,
yep,
I can pretty much make that thing do anything I want it to do.
Right. It's a limiter or a compressor or?
It's a distortion box. It's made by a company called Sound Toys.
Yep.
And, you know, they're pretty amazing people over there. I believe that they were started by Eventide Harmonizer people.
Oh, okay.
And this thing Decapitator just slices the top right off your waveform, right?
Okay. So it would be a brick wall limiter then?
Well, not really. It's got multiple. There's five or six things that it's designed to emulate.
Oh, okay.
And they're all different types of analog equipment that can create distortion, anything from an old Neve channel to some other stuff. So,
right.
And you can, you know, of course, there's a knob that makes it overdrive less or overdrive more.
Yep.
So I think it's better just to get something clean and fuzz it out later.
Totally.
You know, I never record something that's all fuzzed out. Because later on, somebody might say, you know that thing we did that was fuzzed out?
Can we just turn it back a notch? I was like, nope.
Yeah, not anymore.
Yeah.
Although I'm sure there'll come a time by the, you know, when I'm no longer around where there's some box that'll take distortion and reverb off of something.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
We're not there now. So.
No. Have you ever looked at the plugin from iZotope called Trash?
No, but I have their RX plugin.
Oh, RX is amazing.
RX is amazing.
Yeah. I'm still running version 3, but I'm thinking of updating to 6 this month.
Yeah, I have a bone to pick with them. You know, I also have Ozone.
Right.
Which has a lot of nice things in it, but what it doesn't have is the way to put in ISRC codes and PQ codes and metadata and things like that.
Right.
Which you often need for mastering, but it is a mastering plugin and it sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that they'll add those features, you know, in an upcoming revision.
You know? I don't know. That's an interesting one because I would have thought that Pro Tools would have allowed you to do all that stuff via the export or the bounce dialog box, wouldn't it?
Well, if it has, I haven't run up against that. But,
okay.
I'm certainly open to trying it. I have this program called WaveLab,
yep.
which does include all that stuff, but yep. it's got a learning curve and a half.
Yeah, is that Steinberg WaveLab?
It is.
Yeah.
It is Steinberg, and it's a pretty amazing plugin.
Oh.
It's you know, it sounds great, just like the Isotope sounds great, but they work completely different.
Wavelab's not a plugin, though, is it? It's a standalone app.
It is. I meant to say that. It's right. A standalone app. Yeah. Right. I've used it for mastering, and it's It has a learning curve, because, you know, like many companies, the manual talks about what everything can do, but not how you necessarily how you'd use it.
Right. Yep.
So, but once you get past that, I mean, it's pretty good, and the metering on it is phenomenal.
Yep.
And it's got a thing on it, and you'd like this. It's got this thing where even if your plugin doesn't include mid-side, you can use mid-side in Wavelab with any of the plugins that you have. So if you have Waves Renaissance EQ,
yep.
And you call that up in Wavelab, you can use it as a mid-side processor.
Oh, nice.
You know, that alone makes the learning curve worth it.
Yeah, totally. I used Wavelab 15 years ago. I haven't used it since, but I do remember that it was an absolutely brilliant piece of software when I, you know, was mucking around with it. So, but
Now they're at versions 9.5, and it works in Mac and PC.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think the version I used was like version 3 or something. It was a long time ago.
So you were on a PC at the time, right?
Yes,
you were on a PC.
Still am. Yep.
Yeah, you still are.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh God,
mate, you won't get me on a Mac. You won't get me on a Mac.
Oh my God,
I can't stand the Mac.
Okay, so just for those of who don't remember. You know, how different could we be, right? Yeah. So Bruce is using a ribbon mic made by AEA, which is a fantastic mic.
Yeah.
And he's going into a Reaper workstation.
Yep.
Into a PC.
Yeah.
I, on the other hand, I'm Pro Tools, and I have a Rode condenser right here that I'm using. I don't always use the same mic, but, you know, I've got 7 Rode mics that are made near you.
Yeah.
So, you know. And I'm in Pro Tools on a Mac, and I like Pro Tools, so what can I say?
Do you know what? I actually don't record, like when we're recording this podcast and my other podcasts, I don't actually record into Reaper. I actually have a 19-inch rack-mounted Marantz PMD580 flash recorder.
Ah.
And my voice track, as I'm recording this, is actually recording onto a CF card in that flash recorder. And what I do is I can make sure then that no sounds which might normally be generated by the Windows operating system, they don't end up in this recording. So if I'm clicking around on screen doing stuff, none of those sounds will end up in my voice track.
I see.
And that's why I record to that external flash recorder. I used to have a DAT machine, and I used to record my voice tracks to the DAT machine, and then the DAT machine died, and that was, around about 2005, 2006. And, of course, DAT was only a 16-bit format, and I was like, well, DAT's going away. I'm not going to buy another DAT machine, and why would I buy something that only does 16-bit anyway?
And not only that, DAT machines didn't have the greatest converters in the world either.
No. And so that's why I bought this Marantz flash recorder, and it's a beautiful device. I love it.
What do you use for a preamp?
I'm running through the AEA TRP, the version 1 of, like, TRP stands for the Ribbon Pre. So this is the preamp that they designed specifically for the Ribbon.
The guy who makes that for them is like a genius electronics guy. He uses FETs everywhere.
Right.
I can't think of his name right now, but he's like a super brainiac.
Oh, okay.
And he makes amazing equipment under his own name, and I just wish I had that at the tip of my tongue right now.
Right.
But AEA went to him for this preamp because, you know, they're very quality-oriented, and he's just, you know, he's like a real, really high-end guy. So that's a fantastic preamp.
It is. And they've only just, in the last, I'm going to say maybe 3 months, announced the TRP2. Which is a new version of the Ribbon Pre, and I think it might actually be a two-channel version where, this is a two-channel version, but it's only half rack width, and I think the TRP2 might be a full 19-inch width.
So those out there who are wondering what difference does it make that you have a Ribbon mic, it's about gain. You need more gain with the Ribbon mic.
You do.
And, and that's why this preamp needs to be so clean, because one thing you learn in electronics is noise is proportional to gain.
Right.
So that when you turn up the gain, you're turning up the noise.
Yep.
So you need the preamp to be ultra clean, and yours is, I'm sure.
Yeah, oh, it is very clean. And here's the interesting thing. When I bought this Ribbon mic, which was probably, I'm going to say, about 8 years ago now, I was very new to all of this. I didn't understand just how much gain a Ribbon needed, particularly for the spoken word. You know, for instruments, you can get away with pretty much any preamp. And so when I contacted the distributor here in Australia, which is a mob called Mixmasters down in South Australia, the guy I spoke with said, oh, look, I'll send you the whole kit. It comes in a, you know, a rugged hard case, and it's got the the R84 mic, and it's got the TRP preamp, which was, you know, specifically designed for this, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, I don't know if I can afford that. But anyway, he said, look, you know, you can play with it for a couple of weeks. If you don't like it, you can send it back, and, you know, you just pay for the freight. And I went, oh, okay, fair enough. So he sends me the whole thing. And when I got it, I was, you know, very excited. And at the time I was running, and I still own it, it's in my rack, a Focusrite VoiceMaster Pro, which is a mono channel strip.
Right.
So it's a preamp, a de-esser, a noise gate, a compressor, an EQ, a harmonics module, and then your output stage. And then it's got some couple of headphone outputs and a mix knob, so you can do some sidechain input stuff and mix your mic signal with the return from your PC or whatever. And I hooked up the R84 to the VoiceMaster Pro. And what I found was that for my spoken word, I needed the input gain on the VoiceMaster Pro absolutely cranked to the roof to get enough signal driving this R84. And I actually had to then drive the output stage of the VoiceMaster Pro hotter than Unity gain. And to me, that was kind of like breaking the rules. Like, in my opinion, every device should be set at Unity gain at its output stage, because if you've gain staged everything correctly, you should be able to run at Unity gain at the output and be hitting whatever the next device in the chain is at the correct level. And so at that point, I thought, okay, let's get the TRP out of the flight case and plug that in and see what difference it makes. And it is much cleaner than running the VoiceMaster Pro at full whack, you know. So
sure.
So long story short, I ended up buying both the mic and the preamp, and yeah. And it's a two-channel pre, but I only have the one Ribbon mic, so one channel never gets used.
I think that the same designer who made that preamp also makes a card for the Avalon hardware that it's supposed to make the Avalon's sound different or better.
Right.
And they sound good already, but, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's a mod you can do is to put his card in there. And I have not heard it, but I'm sure it's quite good.
Yeah. All right, mate. Well, that's been an interesting chat.
It has, you know. the school thing, man. So if you can get your students to show up on time, you're doing really good.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how it all plays out, whether or not they do run it as a lifestyle course or whether they do decide to run it as an accredited course. I'm a little bit dubious about running it as an accredited course because it's only a computer lab that we're going to be running it in. So it's just a bunch of, you know, 10 computers in a room and everyone's just using a headset mic and headphones, and it's not like it's set up like an actual recording studio. So it's going to be very theory-based, but not a whole lot of practical-based, because they don't have, you know, microphones and mixers and all the sort of audio hardware that you and I are familiar with. I'll obviously take some of my gear in just to show people and get them, you know, a little bit of hands-on experience, but it's going to be limited in what I can do, you know, with a classroom full of people, but only, you know, one mic, one little mixer and, you know, that sort of stuff.
Well, I think you can still do some good for a couple of reasons. First of all, if people want to get started, people are always asking me, how do we get started in audio?
Yeah.
You know, I want to maybe make my living doing that. Well, you have to be a Jedi in workstations.
Yeah.
You just have to be. You cannot even hope, in my opinion, you cannot even hope to get into the audio business unless you're just a stone-cold Jedi on digital workstations, including Pro Tools, because that's so common
yep.
in the business marketplace.
Yep.
And although it's not the only good workstation, it is the one that you need to know. And knowing a couple of others wouldn't hurt either.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, Logic is very popular with composers, but they deliver their stuff to the mixing stage on Pro Tools in Pro Tools.
Yeah, right.
And the other thing about teaching is that this is going to sound corny, and, you know, I don't like corn. But it really is rewarding.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I can't tell you how many students I've saved from buying something really expensive because they read about it by some troll on the on the internet or some forum somewhere.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, I got to work at 192K all the time. You know, come on, you know. You know, I've saved a lot of kids a lot of money, and I've helped some people get there. And it's just incredibly rewarding. It really is.
Yeah.
So you're gonna like that part of it.
I'm sure I will. And I've always said that, you know, there's nothing like trying to explain something to somebody else to help solidify your own understanding of a subject.
True.
You know, the minute you try and explain it to someone else, you really understand just how much you know and how much you don't know. So.
Well, the last time I tried to explain phantom power, I started talking about 6.8K resistors, and I could see their eyes go blank.
Nice. Nice. All right, Doc, I'm gonna wrap it up, matey, because I've got some other stuff I've got to get done today. But great to chat with you again.
You mean this isn't the only thing in your life? You don't put your entire day aside for this? I am shocked. I am absolutely shocked.
I wish.
Okay,
mate. Good to chat.
Okay,
again.
Mate. We'll do this soon.
Absolutely. We will. We'll talk to you again soon.
Hey, put a shrimp on the Barbie for me, will you?
Definitely.
Sign language. Another audio2u.com quality podcast. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@signlanguagepodcast.com.